Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. We'll start, as we always do, with the region's news. In Myanmar, police and armed thugs cracked down on large student groups marching in the city of Yangon. The students have been peacefully protesting for an amendment to a draft education law when they were beaten with clubs and had their leaders arrested. A government minister argued that under Myanmar's current peaceful assembly law, government intervention is still permitted to stop protests if they seem harmful to the state. The South Korean government announced plans to spend $9 billion in the first half of 2015 to stimulate economic growth. The Korean economy currently faces several challenges, including youth unemployment and high household debt. Government figures reported 9% of Koreans between the ages of 15 and 29 couldn't find work in 2014, while an outside estimate from the International Labour Organization stated that 56% of Korean youth between 15 and 29 years old were economically inactive in 2013. In China, the People's Daily published an article on March 11th outlining the government's plan for a gradual adjustment of the retirement age to be rolled out in 2017. Citing concerns over longer life expectancy and the expected increase in the ratio of working age individuals to retirees, the current mandated retirement age is 60 for men, 55 for female white-collar workers, and as low as 50 for female blue-collar workers. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe tasked the government on March 10th to develop a new five-year plan to speed up rebuilding and recovery from the devastating earthquake tsunami on March 11, 2011. According to Japan's reconstruction agency, over 220,000 people still live as evacuees in Iwate, Miyagi, and Fukushima prefectures. Japan honoured the 18,000 killed on the fourth anniversary of the natural disaster with a series of remembrance ceremonies nationwide. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi began a five-day trip to the Seychelles, Mauritius and Sri Lanka this week, arguing that strengthening relations with neighbours in the Indian Ocean has paramount importance. Modi is the first sitting Indian Prime Minister to visit Sri Lanka in 28 years. And that's the news. Also this week, I sat down with CSIS Korea Chair Victor Cha to discuss the attack against US Ambassador to South Korea Mark Lippert. I asked him what the Korean public reaction to the attack tells us about the Korea-US alliance and how this will impact South Korean politics. So, Ambassador Lippert is actually out of hospital today after suffering a horrific knife attack last week. Now, tell us about the reaction that there's been in Korea to this.
I think the general reaction has been outrage. I think that for most Koreans, they saw this as first shocking. You know, South Korean society, you see lots of demonstrations and things on TV, but it's not a very violent society. Nobody has guns or weapons. You don't see metal detectors anywhere except in government buildings. So it's really quite open, very liberal society. And for something like this to happen to a U.S. official, I think was shocking for many Koreans. I observed basically stunned silence. Just people did not know how to respond to something like this. Because we haven't seen anything like this happen to a U.S. official in quite a long time.
And does it signal anything broader? I mean, is there something in the U.S.-Korea relationship that maybe mightn't be as strong? I know that Pew studies have something like 84% of Koreans having a favorable view of the U.S., but is there maybe a section of South Korea that is not quite on that page?
You know, I think it's certainly been played that way in the press a bit. I think when a bunch of politicians went to visit Ambassador Lippert in the hospital, they came out talking about how, you know, this was a problem because the conservatives were too conservative or the liberals, progressives were too liberal. You know, I don't think personally that there's that much politics involved in this. I mean, this was one deranged individual. Who took out his aggression against Ambassador Lippert. He's taking it out against previous officials before, foreign officials, ambassadors in the country. So it's really the case of one individual. Having said that, yes, undeniably there is about a 20% hardcore progressive element in South Korean society. largely people that grew up and went to college during the time of dictatorships in South Korea that had tight military alliance relationships with the United States. They're known as the so-called 386 generation. At the time, in their 30s, went to college in the 80s and born in the 60s. And so you have that grouping that is a part of South Korean society, but they've never reacted violently like this. I mean, they've protested in the past, and South Korea is an open society. It's one of the most vibrant societies in terms of NGO protests and things, but never sort of physical violence, really an attempt at trying to murder a foreign official. So in that sense, sure, I think the media plays up the politics of this a lot, but I think it really is the case of one really deranged individual that was doing this.
So there's no real case for, you know, a U.S. response or a U.S. reaction here other than to plow on?
No, I mean, I think the main U.S. reaction will be an evaluation of security procedures with regard to the U.S. ambassador. It's really kind of a shame because, you know, through the 1980s, really, U.S. ambassadors in Korea could barely go out onto the street. I mean, because of student protests, again, from that 386 generation. But since then, you've had ambassadors, and I've been with them. They walk on the street like anybody else. You know, schoolgirls take out their cell phones to take pictures of them. They're almost like rock stars. And it really went to an extreme. I mean, sort of very much a part of everyday society in Korea. I know Chris Hill used to walk to work. I think Mark Lippert did the same thing. He used to walk his dog in the neighborhood, you know, so just, you know, an average person, which is exactly the image that the United States wants to portray. And in a society that, as you said, is very, very supportive of the United States, 84-85%, sometimes over 90% supportive of the United States. And so the sad thing is that this act by one individual will force them to reevaluate their procedures in Seoul, perhaps in other places. And Ambassador Lippert will have much more security presence than he's had in the past. And future ambassadors, I'm sure, will have more security presence than they've had in the past just because of this one individual action.
And this comes at a time when the U.S. and Korea are cooperating on their big military exercise in the region, which North Korea are perennially saying that this is aggressive and this is something that they're against. Is there any effect on that, or that will continue, obviously?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the exercises will continue. I think this individual, when he attacked Ambassador Lippert, talked about the exercises. And so people, media drew links between those two things. But look, I mean, these exercises are purely defensive. They are done annually. The main purpose of the exercises are to protect South Korea from North Korean aggression. So in no way is this detracting from South Korean security. It's actually enhancing and helping South Korean security, particularly as North Korea's weapons programs only develop and their leadership is very unpredictable. So I think, again, if you polled the majority of South Koreans, they would see these exercises as being something that is key, you know, that is very key and important to their livelihood and their security. And these are not exercises that take place in Seoul. They take place outside of it. So the average citizen in Seoul has no idea that these things are taking place. So they try to keep a very low profile, but at the same time, they are very important for maintaining readiness on the peninsula. This is the most militarized border in the entire world right now. And you have the scariest and most renegade nuclear weapon state on the other side of that border. So to not do these exercises would be irresponsible. And for that reason, I think, you know, the United States government, the South Korean government, as well as the South Korean public, the vast majority of them support them.
And so we can, I mean, summing it up, I suppose we can put this episode behind us as something isolated and as something that isn't sign of anything, a trend or anything like that.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I mean, I certainly hope we can put this behind us, that Mark can heal very quickly, and I'm sure he's already back to his work, really just responded incredibly to this terrible mishap, really a model of sort of calm and cool in spite of what happened to him. And I think, you know, continue to move forward. The only thing that concerns me is that the politics in South Korea is so divisive that There may be efforts to make this more than it is. And I think the other thing that we'll probably see as a reaction by the South Korean public to demonstrations, particularly by NGOs and other activist groups that really try to disrupt society. And we've seen this in the past with protests over beef or protests over all sorts of things. But this kind of crossed the line, you know, when you actually see something like this happen. And so I think it may spark a debate within South Korea about how to handle this. You know, how does a modern society allow for freedom of expression and the ability of others to voice their opinion and try to influence public policy, but at the same time not cross the line where it becomes anarchy or chaos?
Okay, and we of course wish Ambassador Lippert all the best. Thank you, Victor, for joining us.
Okay, thanks.
And that was Victor Cha. Now on to our featured leaderboard for this week, Australia's Gillian Triggs. Gillian Triggs is the president of the Australian Human Rights Commission, a government-funded agency. She was appointed to the position by former Prime Minister Julia Gillard in July 2012. Prior to that appointment, Triggs was Dean of the Faculty at the University of Sydney. Prime Minister Tony Abbott and Attorney General George Brandis berated Triggs over her role in a highly critical Human Rights Commission report released on February 11th on the detention of children in Australian immigration detention centres. The report found that Australia is in breach of international laws and recommended an official inquiry. Abbott called the report a blatantly partisan, politicised exercise and told Parliament on February 24th that his government has lost confidence in Triggs. Triggs has resisted calls to resign. Meanwhile, opposition lawmakers have grilled Attorney General Brandis over accusations that he offered Triggs a new position in exchange for her resignation. The debate about whether Triggs should stay or go is ongoing. The Human Rights Commission's report has struck a nerve among a populace strongly supportive of the Abbott government's strict asylum seeker policies. Whether the government accedes to the Commission's call for an official inquiry into child detention and how the public responds will bear watching. Not everyone in Abbott's coalition supports the attacks on Triggs, feeding rumours of another leadership challenge from within the Prime Minister's own party. Minister for Communications Malcolm Turnbull, often mentioned as a possible successor for Abbott, has defended Triggs as a distinguished figure and dismissed the debate, saying the focus should be on the children in detention. Now we turn to South Korea's aid and humanitarian development priorities abroad. Korea is the first non-European country to transition from OECD aid recipient to OECD development assistance donor. To learn more about South Korea's goals and cooperation with the United States in this area, my colleague Marie Dumond, a research associate with the Korea Chair, caught up with the president of Korea's International Cooperation Agency, Ambassador Kim Young-mok.
Hello, I am Marie Dumond with the CSIS Korea Chair. I am pleased to be here today with Ambassador Young-mok Kim. He's the president of the Korea International Cooperation Agency, or KOICA, and we'll be discussing today South Korea's international development efforts. Welcome to CSIS, Ambassador Kim.
Thank you for this opportunity.
Could you share with us some of what South Korea's priorities have been in international development assistance, both by region and by sector?
By region, I think geographically and culturally and historically, Southeast Asia are naturally the largest recipient countries. Mm-hmm. We are focusing on Asia. We are allocating about 40% of our total budget to this area. By sectors, of course, we are working on many, many different sectors, but mostly we are working on education, healthcare, and medical sector, and also promoting awareness and revenues and putting small farmers in the market that we call New Village Movement, Semar Undong, as part of our agricultural rural development policy.
Do you see these priorities adjusting in the post-2015 environment?
I do think basically there is no need to adjust this policy, but we need more programs. We need more diversity of methodology to create a base for net financial resources, for example, and create the base for bringing new technology know-how and then using the network and market capability of corporates. Those kind of things must be added as part of innovation to create impact and values.
I would next like to take a few minutes to talk about South Korea's development assistance and opportunities for cooperation with the United States.
Well, I think the cooperation with the United States has special meaning because our development has been only due to U.S. aid in forms of helping our campus building and training people, giving us new technology and education, at the same time provide food and infrastructure which were completely destroyed during the war. So if we come out to the global stage, working with the U.S. has a very special meaning for both people of the United States and people of Korea. Then finally, we succeeded to come together and then work along for the sake of other people. Secondly, why we with the U.S.? U.S. is still leading world global development, and then USAID is the largest and the most effective organization still in the world. We can benefit from USAID for different methodology and the histories and their experience. So I think USAID would be happy to work with us, I hope, because we have maintaining and we have still very live experience from the very poor and the most advanced economy and democracy here. So there is a lot of meaning in areas where we can work together.
Well, as you know, in June 2011, the United States and the ROK signed an MOU on cooperation and international development assistance. Are there any programs since the signing of that MOU that you would highlight between the U.S. and Korea that have been especially successful? Yes.
I don't think just signing the MOU has no meaning. It's not many meanings, but putting in place programs, specific programs, has real meaning. We started to create a joint campaign for family health in Ethiopia, and we extended it to Ghana. And now we just started to join in the much more global scale, which we call it Grand Challenge, where we can put our financial resources, we can put our experience and ideas in and teams who can create a really unexpected, unprecedented performance in promoting health for children of under five. So that will be we are in the process of coordinating our programs together. But I think the real things will be starting in Africa on the wider level of countries.
Well, looking forward, are there any areas or ways that you would suggest steps that we could take to further enhance cooperation and coordination with South Korea and the United States in the area of international development assistance?
Well, I think most important thing is to we coordinate on climate change and create a resilience on climate change and keep on our commitment to green growth. We will start something in Vietnam as a pilot project to help Vietnam for going to green growth strategy from now on, because many developing countries are not looking at really the green growth because they are busy with the daily lives, and then they think green growth is something only available for United States or Germany, not for them. We must convince them to go stay on the track. Second one is that we must be able to exchange new methodology and technology. Korea is not as advanced as the U.S., but Korea is famous also for new technologies and becoming a lab and a testbed for many technologies. So I think that we must be able to use technologies and exchange programs so that we can pool the resources and using for the benefit of other people. Third one is I think we must help countries in transition. Countries who have come out of civil wars, who have been dragged into ideologies and against the rest of the world, against imperialists like the United States in the West. But a lot of countries have converted from that narrow-minded ideology to openness. They are eager to help people, their own people, and then a lot of people would like to enjoy the same level of human rights, the same level of freedom, same level of prosperity. So we must help these countries together so that their policy and choice was, to prove their choice was right.
Well, thank you, Ambassador Kim, for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Ambassador Kim Jong-mok. In our One to Watch this week, we look at the sporting excellence of South Asia and Oceania at the 2015 Men's International Cricket World Cup. After 2 months' play in this year's tournament, India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Australia and New Zealand all hold winning records. Among non-Indo-Pacific sides, only South Africa and Ireland looked likely to make the quarterfinals. In fact, since the first tournament was held in 1975, Asian teams have dominated, winning 8 of 10 overall, with Indo-Pacific sides winning 8 straight tournaments. That run looks likely to continue this year. And that's our show for this week. You can find more at cogitated.com and csis.org. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.